Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 192 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Well, they have been protecting, comforting, and helping us for thousands of years, and sometimes even making it tough to record a podcast. That's right, I am talking about dogs. And we know that in the Middle Ages, people loved dogs just like they do today. So for medieval story time today, I thought I would bring you some stories of medieval dogs. So coming up right after the break, we will be talking about medieval dogs and their place in medieval society. So if you looked around the medieval world, didn't really matter where you were, you would find dogs everywhere. They had jobs they would be helping people with, including things like pulling carts, guarding houses, shepherding, which is something that they have been doing for us for thousands of years as well. They were sometimes guide dogs. They were often hunting dogs. And sometimes they were even pets, so lap dogs. And we can find dogs all over the place, not only in medieval stories, but in medieval art. We can find dogs sitting at the feet of masters. Sometimes they are meant to be real dogs. Sometimes they are meant to be metaphorical dogs. They represented loyalty, especially when they were at their master's feet. And sometimes you see this in medieval graves as well. You have a person who is lying down and there's a dog at their feet. And when it comes to graves at such a distance, it can be difficult to really know for sure what these dogs are meant to represent. But it's a good guess to say that they probably represented loyalty, especially when they were at the feet of a woman, because women were often told that they should be like dogs in their loyalty to their husbands. So we know that dogs were everywhere in the medieval world, and sometimes we could find them everywhere because they invited themselves in. Dogs are known for doing this in the Middle Ages. They are said to invite themselves in everywhere, including kitchens and dining halls, of course, but even in churches. The Ancren Rule talks about the devil being like a dog and that the devil will sometimes invite himself in. Nicholas Orme, who I spoke to on this podcast about going to church in medieval England, mentions that sometimes people brought their dogs to church, which was not encouraged. You were not really supposed to do that. And sometimes the dogs just wandered in the middle of a service because you might just leave the door open for a breeze or to allow people to just come in and hear the sermon. And sometimes the creatures who invited themselves in to hear the sermon were dogs. Having a dog in the church would lead to complications. There's one author called Guibert of Nogent who deals with the situation in which you might have a dog eating a communion wafer. And this is tricky because once the communion wafer had been blessed, the piece of bread had been blessed, it was supposed to be part of Jesus's body. And you get in real trouble for doing things like dropping it on the floor, throwing it out, or even throwing it up if you happen to have indulged too much in alcohol. You get in big trouble for things like that because this is meant to be a divine object. So what happens if a dog eats it? So Guibert thinks about this very carefully and says if a dog happens to nibble on or lick or eat a communion wafer, that's fine because the divinity has already fled. There is no problem. You don't have to kill the dog to punish it for its sin. It's fine. The divinity has already left, which is good because this probably happened more than once. We know that dogs love to eat, and sometimes you would find them underneath medieval tables. Although there is a man named Daniel of Beccles who wrote a book all about manners, which I use quite a lot in my new book. The book is called The Book of the Civilized Man. And he says that it's really rude to pet dogs and cats underneath the table. You're not supposed to do that. This is probably not for germ reasons, because germ theory didn't exist. Although people knew that dogs could sometimes get into gross things, they might still have thought it was pretty gross to be petting a muddy dog underneath the table. But also, especially when you are sharing a plate with another person, which is what was done pretty much all the time. So you're not really supposed to do that. Daniel also says it's rude to eat like a dog. So even though dogs have many good qualities, you're not supposed to eat like them. You're not supposed to fight like a dog. But you're also, if you are a master, supposed to treat dogs well. So the actual dogs you might have in your house under the table helping you hunt, he says, don't beat them. Not necessarily because he cares about the dogs, but because it shows a lack of control. It means that you are an irrational person. One of my favorite references to dogs in the Book of the Civilized Man is a little proverb, which is going to be familiar to pretty much everybody, although it's going to sound slightly different because it is several hundred years old. And that is, an old dog cannot learn refinements. So we know that an old dog can't learn new tricks. And in this case, Daniel is saying it's really important to learn your manners early because an old dog cannot learn refinements. So as we talked about in the episode on the medieval swan and the episode on the medieval ass, both of which were really interesting episodes of this podcast, dogs represented not just one thing, but a whole mix of complicated things. So we've already talked about them representing loyalty, sometimes being a form which the devil might take. And of course, when you want to dig into the symbolism of an animal in the Middle Ages, the first place to go is always the bestiary or bestiary. It's hard to know how to pronounce this one because I've heard it pronounced so many different ways. We're going to go with bestiary because that's, I think, an easier way for people to see how it might be spelled if they want to look for it later on. So let's look at dogs and how they were mentioned in bestiaries. So the edition that I have is the translation by T.H. White, and he mentions that the entry on dogs is one of the longest ones that you will find. He says that this speaks to the enthusiasm of the original writer when it comes to dogs and all of the good things they do for people. So here we go. In the bestiary, this is a long one. This is the entry on dogs. The Latin name of Canis the dog is seen to have a Greek etymology, for in Greek it is called Canos. But we must grant that some hold it to be named from the melody, canor, of its barking, since it howls deeply and is said to sing, canora. Now none is more sagacious than dog, for he has more perception than other animals. And he alone recognizes his own name. He esteems his master highly. There are numerous breeds of dogs. Some track down the wild creatures of the woods to catch them. Others guard the flocks of sheep vigilantly against infestations of wolves. Others, the house dogs, look after the palisade of their masters, lest it should be robbed in the night by thieves, and these will stand up for their owners to the death. They gladly dash out hunting with master and will even guard his body when dead and not leave it. In sum, it is part of their nature that they cannot live without men. So much do dogs adore their owners that one can read how, when King Garamantes was captured by his enemies and sold into slavery, 200 of his hounds, having made up a party, rescued him from exile out of the middle of the whole battle line of his foes and fought those who resisted. When Jason was killed in a quarrel, his dog refused food and died of hunger. The hound of King Lysimachus threw itself into the flames when its master's funeral pyre had been lighted and was burnt up by the fire in company with him. In the days when Appius and Junius Pictimus were consuls, a dog which could not be driven away accompanied its master, who had been condemned into prison, and followed him howling after he had been executed. And when, from the compassion of the Roman people, food was offered to it, it carried the victuals to the mouth of the dead man. At last, when the corpse was thrown into the Tiber, it tried to hold the body up, swimming beside it. When a dog comes across the track of a hare or stag and reaches the branching of a trail or the crisscross of the trail because it has been split into more parts, then the dog puzzles silently with himself, seeking along the beginnings of each different track. He shows his sagacity in following the scent as if enunciating a syllogism. Either it has gone this way, says he to himself, or that way, or indeed it may have turned twisting in that other direction, but it has neither entered into this road nor that road. Obviously, it must have taken the third one. And so, by rejecting error, dog finds the truth. Dogs, moreover, have produced evidence to convict culprits with proofs of murder done, to such an extent that their mute testimony has frequently been believed. They say that a man was murdered in Antioch, in a remote part of the city, at dusk, who had his dog on a lead. A certain soldier, servant to the dead man, had done the killing in the hope of plunder. Hidden by the now gathering dusk, this fellow had cleared off elsewhere. The body lay unburied. The crowd of onlookers was dense. The dog stood by. He was weeping for his master's woe with a piteous howl. Now it chanced that he who had committed the murder, such is the deviousness of human cunning, had innocently joined the mob of spectators and approached the corpse as if in mourning, so that he might lay claim to confidence by assuming authority in the middle of the fuss. At this, the dog, putting aside its lamentation for a little while, took up the weapons of revenge, and gripped the fellow tight, and wailing a keen that sounded like some heartbreaking tragic epilogue reduced everybody to tears. And what gave weight to the proof was that the dog only held up this one person from among so many and would not let him go. At length the wretch became terrified, for he did not know how to refute such an obvious testimony, not even by objecting that there was hatred, unfriendliness, envy, or malice among the bystanders, and he no longer knew how to deny the fact. Thereupon, because it was all very difficult, he was put to the torture, in which he was not able to maintain his innocence. In licking a wound, the tongue of a dog heals the same. Its way of life is reported to be perfectly temperate, you see. What is more, the tongue of a puppy makes a salve for men's intestines if they are wounded. The dog's nature is that it returns to its own vomit and gobbles it up again. And if it happens to cross a river carrying some meat or anything of that sort, when it sees its reflection, it opens its mouth, and while it hastens to pick up the other bit of meat, it loses the one which it had. In certain ways, priests are like watchdogs. They always drive away the wiles of the trespassing devil with admonishments, and by doing the right thing, lest he should steal away the treasury of God, i.e. the souls of Christians. The tongue of a dog cures a wound by licking it. This is because the wounds of sinners are cleansed when they are laid bare in confession by the penance imposed by the priest. Also, the tongue of a puppy cures the insides of men because the inside secrets of the heart are often purified by the work and preaching of these learned men. The dog is said to be very temperate in its diet because that man only is truly on his guard who excels others in wisdom and studies, and that is the fellow who must shun all satiety, for Sodom perished of surfeit. Indeed, by no entry can the enemy take possession of man so quickly as through a voracious gullet. The fact that a dog returns to its vomit signifies that human beings, after a complete confession, often return incautiously to the crimes which they have perpetrated. Because it leaves the true food in the river out of greed for the shadow, it symbolizes those silly people who often leave that which is peculiarly of the law out of desire for some unknown thing. Whence it comes that, while they are not able to obtain what they hanker after, what they had before floats uselessly away to loss. So there we go. We have a dog who is amazing and helps it catch culprits. We also have a dog that is returning to its own vomit. So there's the dichotomy of the dog right there. There's also, if you caught it, that Aesop's fable in which there is a dog that wants a bone and so drops the one that he already has in the water. This is a really familiar story, which we're going to come around to again in a second. There's also the mention of the fact that the tongue of a dog can cure things by licking it. This reminds me in a different way of the Book of Good Love by Juan Ruiz, who talks about the fact that you can wear a woman down and gain her affections, just like a dog will keep licking itself until it bleeds. So again, a dog is a complicated figure, as we might imagine. It has all sorts of different symbols that can be associated with it. And when it comes to the bestiary, again, that always comes back to Christianity. So for those who listen to the podcast on the regular, this is not going to be a surprise to you that priests are like dogs. They watch over people. They're loyal and they help to cure sinners. So we were talking about the Aesop's fable of the dog and the bone. This is the one where the dog sees his reflection and thinks it's another dog with a bigger bone, and he goes to bark at it and loses the bone that he has. We see this fable coming up again in the fables of Marie de France. And Marie is a writer who was writing in the 12th century. She wrote a whole bunch of lays, which were stories mostly of knights, kind of romance stories, Arthurian type stories. But she also wrote fables, which were reworkings of the Aesop fables. And she has a few in here that are very interesting about dogs. One of them is the story of the dog and the bone, but in her version of it, it's the dog and the cheese. She also has one about a pregnant hound. This is a dog that is just about to have a litter of puppies. So they beg to find a place to stay. They stay with a relative, and once the puppies are born, they just don't leave. And the moral of the story is, be careful of the people who let themselves into your house and then are really after your inheritance. Watch out for them. The puppies in this story grow up to become the defenders of their mother, who make it so that the person who has initially invited them in can never get them out. There's also a story in here about a dog and a ewe. And this is interesting too, because it's about medieval law. So it's saying that the dog is suing the ewe for bread, which he says that the ewe has and hasn't returned. And the dog brings forth witnesses. One of them is a hawk, and I think the other one is a wolf. And the moral of the story is sometimes people will sue poor people in order to pick over their bones. So in the end of this story, the ewe dies trying to pay back this debt of bread. They didn't have any bread, so they have to sell their wool. And eventually they die, and the dog, the wolf, and the hawk all eat the ewe's body. So this is a statement about how the rich can sometimes pick over the poor people's. It's kind of a subversive story that Marie is telling. There's one that is a lot more familiar about the role of the dog, and that one is called The Thief and the Dog, and I'm going to read that one to you now. So here we go. Here's The Thief and the Dog, as told by Marie de France. This story is of a thief who tried to steal some sheep which he had spied inside the fold of a farmstead. He brought with him a loaf of bread. He meant to give this to the dog, whose job it was to guard the flock. The dog addressed him, "Friend," he said, "why should I take your loaf of bread? I can't repay and must refuse, so keep the bread for your own use." "I ask for nothing," said the thief. "Do take the bread, eat it yourself." "I will have none," the dog returned, "for I can see, yes, I've discerned that you intend my mouth to stuff, so that I can't let out a woof, and then you'd rob us of our sheep because the shepherd is asleep. My master thus I would betray, who's cared for me until this day, and he'd be used most wickedly, a man who raised and cared for me. If he lost all, well, in my keep, when he's fed me to guard his sheep, me, even you yourself would hate, for you would consider me a traitor. I will not earn my bread that way." With this, the dog began to bay. In this example, we see here a model of fine character. If one would buy his services or flatter with false promises in hope that he'll his lord betray, he will refuse emphatically. The same reward he would receive, as dog knew he would get from thief. This is a much more conventional fable in which there's a dog who's loyal to his master, who's doing his job of guarding the sheep and barking when there's a thief that comes his way. And this is a nice example that really keeps the status quo of the people in Marie de France's world. You have people who are loyal to those who are making sure that they stay fed and well kept. But again, with Marie, not everything is so straightforward, because she has another fable of a wolf and a dog in which the dog is talking about how great it is to be kept, and the wolf has some reservations about this. So this is a really interesting fable as well, which I thought I would bring to you, called The Wolf and the Dog. A wolf and dog met on the way while passing through the woods one day. The wolf looked closely at the dog and then began this dialogue. "Brother," he said, "you look so fine, and oh, such fur, how it does shine." The dog replied, "That's very true. I eat quite well, a great deal, too. Each day I make my cozy seat while resting at my master's feet, where daily I gnaw bones, and that is what makes me so big and fat. If you would like to come with me, if to obey him you'll agree, and act like me, you'll have from this more food than you could ever wish." "I'll do that, sure," the wolf replied. Together off they went, allied. Before they'd at the town arrived, the wolf looked at the dog and eyed the way the dog a collar wore and how a dragging chain he bore. "Brother," he said, "how odd is that thing round your neck? I know not what." "That's my chain leash," the dog replied, "with which all through the week I'm tied. For his possessions I would chew on, and many items I would ruin. My master wants them all protected, and that's why I'm tied and restricted. At night around the house I peer and make sure that no thieves draw near." "What?" cried the wolf. "By this you mean you can't go out except with him? Well, you can stay. I won't remain. I'll never choose to wear a chain. I'd rather live as a wolf free than on a chain in luxury. I still can make a choice, and so you fare to town. To woods I'll go." A chain thus brought the termination of friendship and fraternization. Fraternization, probably, but you need to make it rhyme. So Marie does not append a moral to this story, but it is an interesting one nonetheless, where you have the dog who's being very well kept, but in return has to be chained all the time, has restrictions on its freedom. And Marie just leaves that one out there for us to draw our own conclusions about. I think that's fascinating. And I would encourage you, if you haven't read Marie de France's work, either her Lays or the Fables, I would encourage you to do that. There are some good translations which you can access. The one that I've been reading to you from is the one that is from University of Toronto Press, which is edited and translated by Harriet Spiegel. So that is a good one if you'd like to read Marie's fables. Well, we've talked about symbolic dogs, we've talked about allegorical dogs, we've talked about fable dogs. What about the real dogs that were living in the medieval world, who we have evidence of in art and sometimes bones? So we know that they were there, they were real. How were they treated? What were they called? And I think this is one of the things that people are most interested in. One of medievalist.net's most popular articles, I think, from what Peter has told me in the past, was one called Medieval Pet Names. And this was informed by the work of Catherine Walker Michael, who's done a whole bunch of really cool work on medieval pets. She has a whole book on medieval dogs. She has a book on medieval cats. And her work is really interesting and detailed. Some of the medieval dog names that she's managed to pull out, I think you will find interesting and familiar. So think back to the pets that you have owned or the pets that you've known and how they are named. They're usually named for other people's names, like human names. Sometimes they are named for their traits, including their coats, and sometimes their personalities. Sometimes they have grandiose and lofty names and sometimes really ridiculous names. And what is just occurring to me as I'm saying this is we have recorded names of the dogs, but who knows what they were called when it was just them and their owners with them? Because I know from experience that almost every dog that I've met has about 1,001 nicknames. Now, we haven't been able to trace those nicknames, but here are some of the names that Kathleen Walker Michael has found that people actually name their dogs. So some of them she dug up were named Sturdy, Whitefoot, Hardy, Jack, and Terry. Terry is probably my favorite one because it's unexpected, right? Also, Troy, Amiable, Holdfast, and what is probably my favorite in this list of hunting dogs' names is Nosewise. I love that. I should have thought of that one when I was naming my dog. But I named my dog Apollo, which is a very lofty name. And we know that people also name their dogs very lofty names as well. A popular name was Prince. Still a popular name for dogs. Another one, Venus, and another one, Fortuna. So we know that people name their dogs very lofty names as well, but they probably called them something very silly when it was just the two of them alone. So how did people treat their dogs? How did they take care of them? Well, I have a passage for you from The Good Man of Paris, or The Good Wife's Guide. This was written by, in case you haven't heard my other podcast talking about this is written by a man in Paris, obviously, who was writing a manual for his 15-year-old wife, giving her instruction on everything she needed to know to be a good wife to him and then the next husband that she might have if he died. And he mentions, goodness, everything from flea cures to recipes to the best place where you can get beef in Paris, like everything is in here. So of course, he has stuff on dogs because he absolutely loves hawking and hunting. So I'm going to read to you a passage from The Good Wife's Guide by The Good Men of Paris, talking about how to raise young dogs. Know that it is in the nature of young dogs that the more often you lead them to the fields, day after day and hour after hour, and the harder you work them running in the fields from dawn to night, beginning again the next day and every day, and the more you chastise them, since they are well-bred and always together, the more they will fear and love you and willingly follow you and obey. But as soon as you arrive home, be diligent that you yourself or your men ahead of you feed the dogs well. Then give them fresh, clean water in a basin to drink. Next, have them put to bed on nice straw in a warm place in front of the fire if they are wet or muddy, and let them always be held subject to the whip. If you act this way, they will not pester people at table or sideboard, and they will not get into the beds. If you do not care for their needs well, know that when they have worked hard and are hungry, they will scrounge under the table or seize a piece of meat from the sideboard or the kitchen, and they will snap at each other and cause upsets to provide for their needs. In doing so, they tire themselves and do not rest at all, and thus remain beggars and badly behaved, and this is your fault, not theirs. So if you wish to be considered a good ouse-stringer, think first of your sparrowhawk and your dogs, and only after them of yourself. Item. Some say that dogs that bark should be given the lung of rams or sheep to stop the barking. Whether it is true, I do not know. In another part of the book, the good man says that a hunting dog sometimes is brought before the fire and their feet are rubbed with lard to take care of them, probably keep them nice and soft when they're running all over things like rocks and brambles and things like that. And he says, if only wives would treat their husbands this way, everything would be harmonious in the home. Now, something that you've noticed in this probably is that he does mention the whip. People did think in the Middle Ages that it was okay to beat your animals, even though Daniel of Beckville says this is not the best way to get behavior out of them. The good man says the best way to get behavior out of them, even though he does advocate for the whip, is to make sure that their needs are taken care of. And it's kind of interesting that he says put their needs before your own needs, but he says this is the best way to keep dogs from stealing food from the table. These days, I think we really pamper our dogs, and they would probably appreciate this advice from the good man on how to treat a dog well. Give them a nice bed in front of the fire, make sure they have enough food and clean water, and they will always be loyal to you. So we know that people took good care of their dogs. We know that they love their dogs. And there is one story from medieval France in which people actually worshipped a dog. This is the story of Saint Guinefort, and we have it because there was a man called Stephen who went around collecting stories about what was going on in the medieval countryside. And not everything that he came across made him particularly happy about this. His book is called De Superstitione, which gives you an idea of the type of things that he saw people doing. He found that these superstitions were a terrible way to treat God. So he brings up a whole bunch of different examples of these. And the story of Saint Guinefort, I think, is an interesting one. It teaches us a little bit about how people brought together Christianity and old beliefs. So here is the story of the Holy Greyhound. The sixth thing to say is about insulting superstitions, some of which are insulting to God, others to man. The superstitions which attribute divine honors to demons or any other creature insult God. Adultery is one example, or when wretched women sorcerers seek salvation through the adoration of saddles to which they make offerings, through the condemnation of churches and relics of the saints, through carrying their children to ant hills or other places in search of healing. This is what they did recently in the Diocese of Lyon. When preaching there against sorcery and hearing confessions, I heard many women confess that they had carried their children to Saint Guinefort. I thought he was some saint. I made inquiries and last heard that he was a certain greyhound killed in the following way. In the Diocese of Lyon, close to the ville of nuns called Villeneuve, on the land belonging to the Lord of Villars-en-Dôme, there was a certain castle whose lord had a baby son from his wife. But when the lord and lady and the nurse, too, had left the house, leaving the child alone in his cradle, a very large snake entered the house and made for the child's cradle. The greyhound, who had remained there, saw this, dashed swiftly under the cradle in pursuit, knocking it over, and attacked the snake with its fangs and answering bite with bite. In the end, the dog killed it and threw it far away from the child's cradle, which he left all bloodied, as was his mouth and head, with the snake's blood, and stood there by the cradle, all beaten about by the snake. When the nurse came back and saw this, she thought the child had been killed and eaten by the dog, and so gave out an almighty scream. The child's mother heard this, rushed in, saw and thought the same, and she too screamed. Then the knight, similarly, once he got there, believed the same, and drawing his sword, killed the dog. Only then did they approach the child and find him unharmed, sleeping sweetly, in fact. On further investigation, they discovered the snake torn up by the dog's bites and dead. Now that they had learned the truth of the matter, they were embarrassed that they had so unjustly killed the dog so useful to them, and threw his body into a well in front of the castle gate, and placing over it a very large heap of stones, they planted trees nearby as a memorial of the deed. So then Stephen tells the story of an old woman, of course it's an old woman, who helps women who are worried that their babies are changelings, to please the fawns and entreat fawns from the woods to return their babies and leave the changeling babies, who they think are the changeling babies, in the woods. And these babies, as Stephen says, were killed by the ritual. And so this is something that Stephen is hearing from a bunch of people in the same place. It's hard to know whether he is telling the truth or exaggerating. But he says, we went to the place and assembled the people and preached against the practice. We then had the dead dog dug up and the grove of trees cut down and burned along with the dog's bones. Then we had an edict enacted by the lords of the land threatening the spoliation and fining of any people who gathered there for such a purpose in future. So this is interesting for a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, the way in which Stephen says people integrated Christianity and their ideas about the forest and the fauns and changelings and things like that. It also doesn't mention that people were executed for having taken part in this ritual, which goes to show that even though people might have had tangled up beliefs, they might have been worshiping a holy greyhound, even then, even though Stephen found this to be a bad practice, people were not burned as witches for doing this. So I think this is an important part of the story. But there you go, the story of St. Guinevere, the story of a martyr dog. And even though Stephen was very upset by this story and the accompanying ritual, which he conflates, it seems like the changeling stuff had nothing to do with this dog. Stephen would probably be upset to know that if you go on the internet today, you can still find prayers to St. Guinevere, and they are meant to be in protection in some cases of dogs who have passed away. So Stephen probably not like that all that much. So there we have it, a 360-degree view of dogs in the Middle Ages, how they were meant to be treated at home, which is very well and very kindly, how people thought of them as protectors and how they could possibly be martyrs because they were so good. Meanwhile, they might show up as the devil and might cause havoc in church. All of the many complicated sides of dogs. And I hope you've enjoyed this look at medieval dogs. I always like to dig into primary sources every once in a while to get us in touch with how people actually thought back in the day. I hope you've enjoyed this and that having listened to this, perhaps you may appreciate the dogs in your lives even more than you already do. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, I was recently a guest on the podcast Media Evil, and that's the one that talks about medievalism, movies, and things like that. And I came to it wanting to talk about Naruto. This is this very popular anime and manga out of Japan. It's just about to celebrate its 25th anniversary, and it's just a huge worldwide phenomenon. And it has a lot of medieval in it. This is a story about ninjas. I'm a big fan. I plunged into the hundreds and hundreds of episodes that they have. And I wanted to talk about, like, what about the Middle Ages are they borrowing? Because it's a real kind of weird mix of medieval and modern, but it's a fascinating stuff. So besides doing the podcast, I did do a piece called The Medievalism of Naruto on the website, and just talking about some of the themes and stuff like that, you know, some of the stories that get made into parts of Naruto. So yeah, I can't wait to make you watch Naruto.
Yeah, you might need to wait a little bit longer. Right. For the people who are listening, Media Evil is the podcast that's run by Sarah Iftstecker, who was on this podcast just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, she's a wonderful host, a wonderful podcast as well. Yeah, so we have that on the site. The piece actually includes embedded the podcast as well, so you can learn from both. Plus, Stephen Mulberger has a piece on Frederick II, who was apparently a controversial medieval person. I didn't know that.
Well, now we know. I'm sure that every ruler is controversial in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Him more so. So it's a fun little piece on that. And we also have like an update on what's happening at Notre Dame Cathedral and what they're actually learning now that they're able to go into the structure that unfortunately the fire caused, but now they can learn a lot more. So we have a little piece on that as well.
Sounds awesome. You've covered, I think, the entire globe, depending on how you go around it, right?
Our medieval world, yes.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
This week on my new podcast, Extra Medieval, I'll be talking more about medieval animals and their place in society. Extra Medieval is a show I've created just for subscribers where I get to expand on the topics covered on the Medieval podcast, as well as tell you about new articles, historical tidbits, and even modern research. And I do it on audio and video. In this episode, I'll tell you more about what some religious men thought about medieval cats and more about Marie de France. Join me for Extra Medieval on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Patreon. And while we're on the topic of Patreon, thank you to everyone who supports this podcast, as well as other indie podcasters and historians through medievalist.net's Patreon page. Patrons can access all sorts of amazing stuff like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of this podcast and Extra Medieval. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from dogs to hogs, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.